This is the London FinTech Podcast, brought to you by your host, Mike Ballaman, bridging the worlds of suits and t-shirts, of finance and technology, bringing you insights, stories, and inspiration from the golden age of opportunity and innovation happening in London right now.
Hi, this is Mike Ballaman, and this is London FinTech Podcast, episode 29, and I'm delighted to welcome on the show today, Angus Dent, Chief Executive of Archover, a relatively new entrant to the marketplace lending scene in the UK. In the last episode, LFP 028, I was discussing with David Stevenson, in the context of his new academic journal of disruptive finance, whether innovation is episodic or continuous. Well, whatever the answer to that is, in the abstract, Archover are a practical example that if you are a new kid on the block, you have to come up with something other than a Me Too approach to make not just waves, but a good business. This year, I've been writing a whole series of articles looking at alternative finance risk from a grown-up FS perspective. My overall conclusion is that the industry is doing well, has come far, but needs to go a lot further, and in particular, needs to avoid the siren call that somehow ticking regulatory boxes is enough when it comes to controlling risk. Archover practice what I consider a very interesting approach to limiting risk, and that's why I invited Angus on the show today. Their model is called secured and insured lending. Firstly, they secure their loans to SMEs on the accounts receivable of the borrower company. Secondly, the borrower has to insure those accounts receivable, which allows Archover to take a first charge on them. This allows the borrower to lower the cost of borrowing as they leverage their strength of the customers. Vice versa, the lenders get more secured and less risky loans. This all sounds wonderful, although whenever I hear the word insurance, I always recall various examples where I had to plough through the minutiae of my home contents insurance policy only to find pensive loopholes and disappointment. So perhaps the devil in this model is also in the detail. Plenty to talk about, so let's get on with the show. Hi Angus, thanks for joining me today.
Good afternoon, Mike. Thank you for inviting me.
So before we dive into the excitement that is secured and insured, and every time I hear that phrase, I can't stop thinking suited and booted, but maybe you're both. I see that you're a director and founder shareholder of Aston Martin Club Racing. I assume at the heart of the P2P world, there's a kind of car-loving Masonic lodge, as when Zopa Giles was on the show, he was also talking about racing cars too. Is it that way around, that there's Masonic lodge at the heart of P2P, or do you just need to all go and create billion-dollar unicorns to pay for expensive hobbies, as after all, pranging an Aston Martin would surely require a large dose of secured and insured, as well as no doubt suited and booted.
I'm sure it would. I haven't been invited to join the Masonic Lodge of of crowdfunding car racers. My involvement with car racing has always been at a very, very low level, always the amateur side of it. But yeah, I suppose you could say that my first foray into crowdfunding was actually when we set up Aston Club Racing, because a group of 14 of us got together.
Roughly when was that?
That's just 3.5 years ago now. And we bought the rights from the Aston Martin Owners Club to run their race series in the UK. And we've been doing it since. We go to half a dozen circuits around the country. All the obvious ones. Centrepiece is our two-day meeting at Brands Hatch.
Oh, it's funny you mentioned Brands Hatch, because I was just thinking back to probably about 20 years ago when I went on a few weekends of a course on how to drive single-seater monocoques around Brands Hatch.
Okay.
Which is quite exciting, particularly the time when it was in the rain, when I fortunately I managed to do a 360-degree spin and just be pointing the direction I needed to be pointing in and carried on, actually, which looked incredibly cool from the outside, because it was incredibly fortunate from the inside.
Yeah, I mean, Brands is a great place. It's one of the last real amphitheatre circuits, nestling in the Downs. Also happens to be just up the road from where I live, so very handy.
Excellent. And how many races a year are there then?
Well, we organise 6 meetings a year, 6 days of racing, if you like, at which we will have probably 5, maybe 6 races at each day.
And how does the insurance work then? I mean, talking about insurance, my teenage daughter is about to pass her driving test, touch wood, and then you look at the cost of insuring a 17-year-old.
When you're on the circuit, generally you're not insured. There are specialists who will cover you. As you can imagine, the excess is, let's say excessive. As far as I'm aware, the majority of people don't bother. I think the exception is perhaps when you're driving somebody else's car.
Right.
Because, you know, even amongst friends, the expression, if you bend it, you mend it, it's the way it's done, shall we say.
Yeah. Well, presumably it's relatively gentlemanly in that people don't want to write off other people's cars either, or their own.
That's absolutely right.
It's not like sort of stock car racing.
No, it's not stock car racing. You know, Frank Williams is not sitting on the pit wall with a contract for you, and you are going to have to pay the bills yourself if it all goes wrong. So yeah, that does calm people down.
So talking of Frank Williams, not likely to talent spot you and having to pay the bills yourself, maybe we can move on to this whole interesting issue of insurance and marketplace lending and secured and unsecured and all that kind of thing. So just going back to the big picture here, what is the gap in the market? Why is there a need for this whole sort of area, which has been going for quite a long time, which you might broadly call, I guess, invoice-based financing or something?
Well, figures vary on how big the gap in the market is, but it's certainly over £1 billion. If you look at lending, overall lending to SMEs, with the exception of the first quarter of this year, it has declined quarter on quarter, every quarter since 2007.
In the UK?
In the UK, just in the UK. And I'm sure that's replicated in the US and across continental Europe as well. So there is a huge gap. And if UK PLC is to start really growing again, then that will drive an increase in the need for working capital in businesses. Now, there are lots of different forms of asset-based finance, of course, which can help businesses, leasing, etc., against the plant and equipment. But one of the biggest forms of finance is, of course, invoice discounting. And what's happened, certainly over the, well, probably been going on for maybe as long as 20 years, but has really accelerated in the last few years, is that the banks, as they have withdrawn from offering overdrafts, have pushed companies down the route of invoice discounting.
Right. And just for those people who have never discounted an invoice in their life, that means what?
That means you have an agreement with a subsidiary of a bank, and every time you raise an invoice, you send it electronically to the invoice discounter. They are maintaining, if you like, a parallel sales ledger with yours.
So I send an invoice to Tesco's for 1,000 gallons of milk, for example.
Say it's 1,000 gallons of milk, and let's keep it simple, let's say it's a £10,000 invoice, then the invoice discounting company would probably advance you £7,000 against that. Now, depending whether it's disclosed invoice discounting or non-disclosed invoice discounting, Tesco's would then either pay you or pay the invoice discounter. Let's assume that it's non-disclosed, because that's, I think that's the most prevalent form. So the money comes into you and your ledger is then clear, but you've got to tell the invoice discounter that you've had that money. The effect it tends to have is that you've got to run faster and faster all the time to keep feeding that machine, to keep getting those advances. It's okay. I mean, if you are the kind of business that maybe raises 2 or 3 invoices a month, then it can work quite nicely. If you're the kind of business, say you're in the milk supply business, yeah, you'll be raising an invoice to Tesco, Waitrose, Sainsbury's every day of every week. Yeah? That very quickly becomes a nightmare to manage the two sales ledgers.
So in terms of fintech solutions, the obvious leader is Market Invoice.
Yeah.
In the pure invoicing sector. So how is the approach that Archover have? What's the compare and contrast?
Well, our approach is to look at all of the invoices together in what we call an invoice pool. So you take them together rather than taking them in the granular invoice by invoice way.
So by and large, everybody else deals with granular invoices?
As far as I'm aware, everybody else deals with granular invoices, yes.
Coming back to the importance of this, because it sounds accountancy related, because it is, this accounts receivable phrase, hidden behind that apparent technicality is really the fact that actually you're just looking at all invoices rather than an invoice, yeah?
Yes.
So if I need a bit of cash here, I'll invoice discount an invoice to get a bit of cash coming in now rather than waiting for 3 months or whenever it is they're going to pay me.
That's right. So what Market Invoice will do is very much, if you know, you've got an invoice for £100,000, you need £70,000, you take that invoice to them, they advance against it. The traditional invoice discounters do that on a more continuous basis, although I think Market Invoice do as well. But if you have your invoices in a pool and you maintain the total of those invoices at a particular preset level, then what we're doing is we're facilitating long-term, fixed-term lending against that pool of invoices.
So in a sense then, would it be fair to say that what you guys are doing is much more like traditional asset-based finance, with the only twist that you're treating, you know, the whole balance sheet's accounts receivable as the asset?
Yes.
As opposed to invoice discounting, which is, here is my invoice, here's my piece of paper, can you give me some dosh for this kind of thing?
Yeah, instead of saying the accounts receivable are a divisible set of assets. Yeah. We're saying it's one asset. It's almost like saying that the accounts receivable are equivalent to a digger.
Exactly, yeah? That's right. Yeah, exactly, or property or something like that. So that's nice and simple and clear then. So if I'm an SME, then potentially I've just suddenly heard of a new way of raising finance, which is to use the accounts receivable as a whole in the entirety without going through the pain of doing it one by one. So then, as I was trying to explain, no doubt poorly in the introduction, if I get a deal with you and you give me some money, you will use the accounts receivable as security, somehow take a charge at company's house. I didn't quite understand how that bit worked. I thought you were going to take a charge over things rather than abstract things, but anyway, you can explain that. And then also insured. So how does this sort of secured bit work, and then how does the insured bit work?
Right, well, the secured bit, as you say, is about a charge at company's house. Right.
And so just because I'm an idiot, how do you take a charge over something that's a bit abstract, like accounts receivable?
You take what is known as a floating charge. Yeah. So the underlying asset can change, but you have a description of what that floating asset is.
I see.
So in our case, the floating asset would be all accounts receivable, yeah? Or potentially it could be a named group of customers or something like that. But generally it would be all accounts receivable. Yeah. You can get a charge over that, register that at company's house. Becomes a fixed charge if it crystallises.
Yeah, and just as I'm conscious that the podcast now listened to in 90 countries in the world, not all of which might necessarily understand the word charge, basically that's a bit like having a mortgage out on your house.
It's exactly like having a mortgage on your house.
Exactly, which is you've got your hands on it, it's legally kind of yours, and you can whip it off from the company if you need it.
And just like what we have in the UK, of course we have company's house who will register these charges and display them to everybody so that it's clear what is going on. What we do as well is we focus the charge purely on the accounts receivable. Yeah. So all of the other assets, the stock, the fixed assets, etc., are all free for other pieces of finance. So, you know, if you have a Lloyd's bank against the factory, yeah, you have somebody at Legion or somebody like that against the stock, that's fine. We can all work together. So we're not taking more security than we need.
Right. So that's nice and simple and clear. And at this rate, it will be one of the shortest podcasts ever. And then we get onto the bit where...
Well, we do try very hard to keep it simple and, you know, transparent and all those other great buzzwords.
Exactly. And so far, so good. So then we dive into the murky world of insurance. And as I fessed up front, I and no doubt many others have had the issue, whether it's contents insurance or car insurance or travel insurance or something like that, that you sort of kind of insure. And then certainly when you're a domestic punter, you don't really read 15 pages of blah, blah. You go, yeah, okay, I've got contents insurance. Yeah, the excess is so-and-so. Right, you forget about it. And then later you come around and look at the detail, and there's a lot of detail and there's always gaps in the detail. So obviously you guys are professionals at this and you've got very good contacts in the marketplace. So just at the big picture for the moment, how does alternative finance really approach the whole insurance? I mean, off the top of my head, Lending Works also using insurance against some of their people losing jobs or something like that to reduce their risk.
Yes. I mean, that's a different form. That's obviously personal lending. But yeah, I mean, that's a use of insurance. I mean, the use of credit insurance to support borrowing is not something we invented. We invented the crowdfunding part of it, if you will. But you're right. I mean, the comment you made in the introduction, the devil in the detail. It is in the detail. We always involve a proper FCA registered credit insurance broker who will come out to any company that's borrowing money across our platform and explain to them not only what the policy does, but how the policy works. Because you do have to keep reporting to the credit insurer what's going on. When the credit insurer doesn't pay out, it's usually because 6 months have gone by, you, the borrower, have known that there's a problem with this particular customer, and you've not told anybody about it. Credit insurers don't want to pay out, of course. Part of what they've got is they've got lots of lawyers, they've got debt collection agencies. What we also do is we are the joint insured as well. So if you, the borrower, aren't making that reporting properly, we'll step in and make those reports on your behalf. So the policy is run properly. So we don't get to the position where it's just an expense and you're getting no value from it.
Right. And so just taking a sidestep then, so as you're saying, and it's interesting hearing about the operational processes that the credit insurers have to ensure that it's all keeping on the straight and narrow, because coming back to these articles I've been writing. FS risk as a whole has gone badly astray in the last 30 years, as I explained in the most recent article I wrote. And one of the reasons is, in a sense, a lack of professionalism around the whole thing. You know, but insurance companies have been at this for centuries, and they know that one of the best things for all concerned is to minimise the risk by having good operational processes, rather than going, oh yeah, you're insured, I'm sure that's fine, and forget about you, kind of stuff.
That's right, and that was one of the things that first attracted us to the credit insurers, was not so much the credit insurance as a product, but their ability to do credit analysis. Because we, as Archover, yes, we have our own credit analysis procedures, but they are nothing like as well established as those of the credit insurer.
And going back to credit insurance, and it's one of these sort of things, I'm not quite sure how the crossover works between insurance and banking, because there is a bit of a divide. So obviously in banking, we've had things like credit default swaps and all that kind of stuff have been around for a while, and they've been a bit of a bloody disaster because of the small print, and they never quite worked, and, you know, grease this, and the shareholders get together, or bondholders get together, and they call it an X rather than a Y, and it doesn't trip over. So how does the credit insurance market as a whole work? I mean, by and large, again, as just a generalisation, the insurance sector tends to like to keep a good reputation. I mean, Lloyd's been quite a good example. Yeah. It's much more like My Word Is My Bond days.
Yes, it very much is. Yes, there is paperwork, but the paperwork very much follows behind with credit insurance, as it does, I think, with most types of insurance. And it is The Word Is My Bond. It is built on reputation. And the credit insurers generally do have a good reputation.
And what's the bread and butter of their business then? I mean, don't say credit insurance. Well, you can say credit insurance, but then I'll ask you well, what that means to go over again.
No, I mean, credit insurance has always run alongside, I think, where we really started with export-related business.
Okay, ECGD.
Yeah.
Export Credit Guarantee Department.
Yeah, exactly, and the forerunners of that and that sort of international trade where you didn't know and maybe had less way of checking what the customer's creditworthiness was, so you involved somebody else. It's obviously gone on a lot from that. I mean, the credit insurance is, as I said, used an awful lot alongside other forms of finance.
Yes, so that's interesting. I mean, the one reason I'm just kind of casting around in my head, as it were, is that clearly what you're doing is a very interesting model, and it's obviously good for the borrower and potentially good for the lender, and as the years go by, you'll have a track record which will show how good it is. But I'm wondering, in a sense, though, going to ask another silly question, is why hasn't anybody done this before? That's always a silly question, because the first person to do something the first time goes, well, because nobody else thought of it, or something like that.
I think, fortunately, that's about right.
Yeah. So there literally is a gap in the market that, you know, accounts receivable have never been considered, along the lines of also having credit insurance. So you've got two credit analyses of the borrower company. You've got an operational process from them, and no doubt from you insuring all the sort of the things done.
So, quite right.
Again, this secured and insured, I mean, it's two words, isn't it? But a bit like belt and braces, to a degree.
Yes, it is like that. And it's double all the way around, if you will, because there's double credit analysis, because we do it, and the credit insurance company do it. The security, it's a well-tried and tested process.
Yeah, and so then, quotes, all you need to do, unquotes, is once you've had your nice, simple business model and idea and you see the gap in the market, then all you need to do, quotes, unquotes, is execute, which is presumably fairly straightforward.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, you know.
Before you know, you've done $1 billion of business.
Yes, just
always a bit harder than that.
Well, some days it seems to be a bit harder than that, yes. Not all the time. Invoice discounting, etc., is very well established in the UK. Nobody wakes up on a Monday morning and says, I must borrow some money today. I've just decided that. Yeah. Companies have a need to borrow money, driven by wish to expand, their customers have just extended their payment terms, whatever.
Events,
whatever that might be. And most borrowers don't really care where they get the money from. They want the money. They just need the money. It's an irritant almost that's slowing their business down. Yeah. So if they have been used to invoice discounting, or they are fortunate and then they can actually get a bank loan, likely they will stick with it. What we've seen in the past, in the last little while, and this was something that was really brought home to me at the Trade and Export Finance Exhibition last week, sitting on a panel, and the chairman asked two entrepreneurs on the panel, if they were looking to raise money for their business, where would they go first? And they both said to alternative finance, to Alt-Fi. Yeah? And then the chairman asked the sort of subsidiary question, when would you go to the bank? One of them said never, it would be a complete waste of time. And the other one said last.
Right, yeah. Fantastic.
Yeah, which is great, you know, lovely to hear. And I sort of, you know, gave them both the tenor that I promised them.
Exactly, that's right.
But we sat on the panel. It was great, but it is a huge change. And, you know, people are generally conservative. Both the entrepreneurs concerned were younger people, certainly younger than me anyway, 20 or so years younger. So, I don't know, maybe still more willing to accept different things. I think the other thing for us is that crowdfunding generally is seen as something of perhaps a few tens of thousands of pounds, whereas, you know, our average loan is £220,000. There's a couple on the platform at the moment for £500,000 each. It's breaking that perception that crowdfunding is only for the very little, the small loans, etc.
Yes, that's the trouble with all these words, isn't it? Like P2P or crowdfunding, all that. So have you got institutional funds or retail investors on one side of the platform and the borrowers on the other, or a mixture? Or...
Yes.
Yes, yes to all the above.
Yeah, yes, exactly. I mean, we approach this perhaps slightly differently to others in that we went out and recruited a small crowd of lenders first, because what we realised fairly early on in the business was that we actually need more trust from the borrower than we do from the lender.
Oh, that's interesting. How does that work then?
Well, if you're a borrower, your business wants to do something, and maybe your business needs to do something. Yeah. If we can't raise the money for you, your business is going to change at the very least. In an extreme situation, you might actually go out of business.
Exactly, yes. It might spoil your whole day.
Exactly. So you've got to absolutely believe and trust that we can do what we say we can do, which is help you raise this money.
And this is generally, of course, one of the main problems that people moan about with banks, which is that the banks dick them around for 6 months and that keeps saying yes, yeah, and oh, no, yeah. Actually, oh no, some committee said no, sorry about that.
Yeah, that's right. So we want to get you from, say, this afternoon, here we are, Thursday afternoon, you come in, we have a look through your basic information, you send us a load more information, and so perhaps by not the end of next week, but perhaps the beginning of the following week, you've got the money raised and, you know, you're on with your business, and that whole business of having to raise the funds is over and done with for the next 24 months.
Yeah, and so you quote, I think sort of Funding Circle, where the loans are there and people are bidding and the price is changing, but it's simpler with you, is it? You just quote a rate?
Absolutely, because one of the effects of the credit insurance, or one of the other effects, is to equalise or homogenise the risk between different businesses, because, if you like, the credit insurance is taking up that bit of slack. So that allows us to very simply just publish rates and then the crowd to come along and say, yes, I like that company, I like that rate, I've got some money, I'll put it to it, or not.
It's interesting because one of the other things I've been writing about, obviously, is the use of provision funds in the case of Zipper and rates that have been the most obvious ones. And to an extent, that's like kind of trying to have an internal insurance vehicle.
It is.
Which is good as far as it goes. It's worked very well so far. Touch wood, it works well for a long period of time. But the thing about insurance, of course, is that insurance, amongst other things, is a volume business. If I insure one car, if I insure your Aston Martin, I'm either going to make a nice little bit of money or lose a bloody fortune. Once I've insured a million Aston Martins, it's going to even out somewhat.
You struggle with that because I haven't made a million. But
as soon as I said that, I was wondering whether over the entire time around all the world a million had been done.
Yes, I mean, the basic point you make is absolutely correct. You want a portfolio. That is what the credit insurers are doing, of course. You know, they are playing that numbers game, and we are benefiting from that game across the whole market, not just in what we do.
And then presumably what comes out of the bottom in the machine, as it were, or the left side of the website or the right side of the website, is a bunch of assets which are, quotes, very low risk, unquotes, which hopefully have got attractive rates for lenders, given that you get what you pay for. And, you know, if it's not very risky, then you're presumably going to get a lower return than if it is very risky.
We talk about high levels of security rather than low levels of risk.
Right, okay.
And that's what we're doing. We're building security, so you have the charge, you have the credit insurance.
Yeah, and then so typically an asset on your platform, if people are coming to look at it this afternoon, will be what kind of period of time, what kind of interest rate at the moment, roughly?
The majority of loans that we have facilitated are for 24 months, about a little bit over £220,000, paying the lenders, I think, 6.75%, cost to the borrower, 8.25%.
And you're one of the few people in P2P who actually disclose the lender rate, which is quite nice and transparent. Lots of people talk about transparency, and then that's one of the big secrets of many of the platforms. So I'm very clear, Angus, that this is a nice simple, clear, innovative model, and in principle it can work very well. And then, of course, joking aside, the reason that you need cheap executives and all that kind of stuff is that execution in any business is always a little bit more complicated than it appears. And that's fairly standard as time goes by. So where is Archover now and where is it going? I mean, how do you play catch-up in a race when lots of other people sort of set off running a few laps ago? Or maybe it's not even catch-up, but how do you attract assets? How do you attract interest? How do you get the word out there in a very busy digital world where there's a million websites to read?
That's right. That is the challenge, is to get the word out there, as it is with any business. The classic, we've built what we believe to be a very good mousetrap. Now we've got to go and tell people about it. And we do that in, I suppose, three ways, really. One is with what you might call traditional stuff, case studies, articles in magazines, attending exhibitions, general bits of PR, talking to journalists. Maybe this podcast will help, that kind of stuff. We're also focusing very heavily on social media. We see a bit of a gap where other crowdfunding companies, alt-fi companies, have not really focused or not done it well in the social media space. So we are really hammering into that. We began that really at the beginning of this month, and we'll see what the results are. But there's an interesting survey from actually Goldman Sachs as to where those who are either just coming to really run businesses or are heavy influencers on those who are running businesses are getting their references from, are getting their sources of information from. And something like 64% of them, I think it was, said they were coming from social media, which is a big turnaround in the last 5 years. So that's one area that we are really concentrating on.
My observation on the social media one, given that I follow all this bloody stuff half the time, is that the mistake that many companies do when they get a bit larger is they have a social media department, or if they're smaller, they outsource it to somebody else, and kind of social media becomes the core of it. And it just sounds so plastic. It sounds like everybody else is bloody social media because it's social media. Yeah. And I think it's far better not to center it on social media, but actually it's just a channel to put your message down in your own words. You know, the companies that do that, it's a bit fresher.
Yeah, okay, you're right, I'm sure.
Although the people who just outsourced your social media to this morning wouldn't agree.
No, I mean, they probably wouldn't, but then some of the language, quite honestly, so opaque that I wouldn't know whether they're agreeing with me or disagreeing some of the time. You're right, it's a channel, and what we've got to do is we have got to keep creating content, if you will, writing blogs, which we or I try and do twice a week, writing articles.
But that's what I mean, though. But if you're writing it, it's going to be fresher than if a company writes it for you.
Oh, yeah. And the guys to the social media company that are helping us, because we have outsourced it because we can't do everything. No, they're not writing the content.
Yeah. I see some cases where companies who have been on the show have given it to an outside company who do the lot. And it sounds so plastic because they're not actually talking from first person.
No.
And then it just becomes generic. And then the other thing I see, of course, is because every 2 weeks I'm releasing a show, which I've done with quite a few companies by now. And of course, I get the sort of statistics and the downloads and all that kind of thing. And originally, when I came into this whole thing, I thought, oh, those people have got a social media department, or those people have got, you know, well-known names doing it. Yeah. They'll get the most downloads. Well, funny enough, it's not actually. The ones that have got the most downloads is where there's somebody who's really keen and really passionate about the company doing it himself, in it part-time kind of stuff. So there's some ironies in here.
Yes, and I'm sure passion will show through in what you write, which you'll never get from somebody who's just a hired gun, as it were. Yeah. But we're busy trying to use that channel, get the message out, and then we also have a program coming in the autumn where we're going to try and take over some city centres and blanket particular cities, so look out Leeds.
Oh, right. Oh, no, you're not going to start doing the transfer-wise thing of having naked people running around in soap suds. Or the rate setter zombies walking around town.
Well, I rather like the rate setter zombies, actually.
You prefer zombies to naked people? It's only age, actually, isn't it, actually?
Well, probably. you better cut that bit. But there will be some sort of stunt around it. I mean, I think we're looking at tethered balloon rides or something like that at the moment. The biggest challenge is undoubtedly
the last mile.
Getting the name out there, getting people to know. I mean, you know, yesterday we were at the NACFB show, and there were, you know, good quality brokers, loan brokers coming up onto the stand and saying, who are you? Archover, never heard of you. And we've got to get away from that.
Seems to be all going in the right direction. And as listeners to the show will know, I've got 30 years in financial services risk, and I've spent the last 6 months thinking about financial services risk as a whole in the context of alternative finance. And as I said at the beginning, I concluded that actually it's done very well, but there's quite a long way to go, and there's quite a lot of complacency, and there's quite a lot of opportunity to improve on it. And I really do think, Angus, and it's not flattery, that you're secured and insured lending to SMEs via the accounts receivable is a very innovative model, and it's something that deserves to succeed, and I'd recommend highly that people check out, because it is quite interesting. As you say, by now it's explicable in a fairly sort of straightforward way. So I wish you every luck.
Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you. Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe on iTunes or your podcast app, or sign up at londonfintechpodcast.com for email alerts and new episodes. Live long and prosper.
We could sit in a bender all day, watching the firelight dance, watching the firelight dance. We could walk in the mountains before dawn, watching a happy moon ride, watching a happy moon ride. To come away from the city with a tarmac so dead and the people so sad. Come away from the city with the faces so grey, with the pain of the everyday. Like the mountains and the trees, can you see what I mean? Can you see what I mean? We fit in between the earth and the sky. Kiss the city goodbye, wave the city goodbye. Wave the city goodbye. City goodbye. Watch the firelight dance with me. 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 Watch the firelight dance.